Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's a beautiful spring day here in Wolverhampton and we're having another nice walk along the canal. Lots and lots of birds, they're all very excited, as you can hear all around us. Today we're going to read and discuss chapters 6, 7 and 8 of the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu.
Chapter 6 and 7, they're a bit of repeating themes that kind of get dealt with. It's very repetitious, you know, and so they'll be kind of quite quick, I think. Chapter 8 introduces a new theme, I think. Well, partly new.
To do with the sage.
To do with the sage and water.
Yeah.
So,
we have discussed that a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, there has been some discussion of the sage, but this is how it works. It's repetitious. It comes from different angles.
I've certainly found with many of the similar themes that we've talked about over the last 20 years, it's been quite helpful to come at the same thing from a number of different angles over time, which I think is what he's doing here.
Yeah, he's a perspectivist, I think, you know.
Yeah.
and does realise that you can communicate in the face of the difficulties of language and problems around trying to F the ineffable. You can still never get some kind of purchase and achieve some kind of communication by circling the object of your interest and giving perspectives, you know, get from the east to the west, the south and the north, you know, and say, okay, you've got the material now to get a bit of a rounded view.
Yeah.
You know, and as a method, I think it pays off. Anyway. Chapter 6. The Tao is the breath that never dies. It is a mother to all creation. It is the root and ground of every soul, the fountain of heaven and earth laid open. Endless source, endless river, river of no shape, river of no water, drifting invisibly from place to place. It never ends and it never fails.
I mean, to be, that's sort of quite self-explanatory, really. It almost needs no comment, but what do you think?
Well, I think it is astonishingly successful as poetry in having to go at F in the ineffable. I mean, he's already told us that we can say nothing about the Tao, but he's gonna damn well have a go.
Yeah.
You know, the whole log, including the postage. So the Tao is the breath that never dies. Now that's interesting, you know, this association with breath. And as you know, all of the world's spiritual traditions have got like a deep interest in the human breath. You know, particularly in yoga, Taoism, Vajrayana, there are specific breathing methodologies and exercises which are used to manipulate the psyche in the hope of catching some kind of glimpse of this Tao or whatever the equivalent is in these other traditions. Mm. And Lao Tzu is saying, well, the Tao itself is like breath. And I suppose the idea is that if we can work with breath, that we will be emulating the Tao, and we might kind of, in that kind of magical emulation, catch some kind of a glimpse of what it's about and what he's on about with all this. I mean, personally, I think that we really don't need to over manipulate in that direction. You know, I can't, what I take from Taoism is this exhortation not to be over manipulative either of ourselves or the world, and so on. And I take that, you know, over and against rather more manipulative approaches. But nevertheless, that is a connection that's drawn. You know, that was an understanding that's been around for a long time. That breath and psyche are intimately interwoven. The very saying the Tao itself is the breath. It's a breath that never dies. Unlike our breath, which of course has, you know, an individual human gets so many breaths. There's a start to the breathing process and an end to the breathing process for a particular individual and for individuals in general. But the Tao, since the Tao is this great universal principle, that particular breath never dies. But what's important there is the notion of pulsation. The breath, of course, is a pulsation. It's an in, a turn round, and an out, and a turn round, and an in, and a turn round, and out, and a turn round. And it's a rhythm. It's a pulsation. And Lao Tzu is likening the Tao to that. He's seeing this kind of pulsational quality in the Tao, the vibrational quality of it. And I think this is something that you kind of happen upon in meditations, especially if you go in for, like, again, not being over manipulative, but allowing things to settle, rather, you know, that kind of going with the flow that allows things to settle and settle and settle. And then in those states, those contemplative states that can come about as a result of engaging in that process, you do sometimes feel and see almost the kind of pulsation of the universe. You can feel the universe breathing. And he's got a deep, resonant, inhuman, you know, and slow kind of rhythm of expansion and contraction, of in and out, of rising out and swelling and falling back. And you can kind of feel it. It's like there's a meditative observation that I think is over the centuries, has been known. I don't think it's well known. I don't think it's well known, because you have to go in pretty deep to happen upon it. But that thing, it's like the whole universe is just breathing, and you're going, wow, the fucking universe is breathing, man.
yeah,
man. Well, you know what I mean. That kind of scenario, and it's an amazing experience. And I think Lao Tzu is alluding to that there. You know, that feeling that when you settle down, you have somehow come into the presence of something very fundamental. Can I put it like that?
Yeah.
And that fundamental presence has got this pulsational nature and vibrational nature. So there you go, in half a dozen words, he's give us that. It is the mother to all creation. Well, we've had this, haven't we? You know, he keeps saying this. So everything comes out of it. It's nothing, but everything comes out of it. And I think this is the theme where we've explored on in the last three podcasts. It is the root and ground of every soul. Well, it's in you. It's not just in the world, it's in you. The root and ground of every soul, every human individual, every psyche has got this, the root and the ground. It's underneath, you know. Lao Tzu is what we call like a down mystic, you know. There are up mystics and down mystics. Up mystics, their soul flies off into the heavens or into the realm of the ancestors. Down mystics, they sink down into something more primordial, more earthy, into the ground. They send roots into the ground, you know. And those roots in the ground of things is the Tao itself. Again, it's this very fundamental experience of down mysticism, of being grounded, of being in the earth, of having roots. And of course, roots are these organs of process, you know, of bringing in nutrition and fluid and taking it up. through the sap of a tree and out through the leaves into the atmosphere. And a tree is this joining of heaven and earth. It's a tree, you know. And Lao Tzu is pointing us towards the root aspect of that, the root and the ground of that, you know, to the underneath bit. And the Tao is particularly evident there for us. If we meditate in that particular way, it's the fountain of heaven and earth, wide open. Well, again, it's poetry, trying to F the ineffable, but I like that, wide open. There is a sense in which, though it's difficult to talk about this stuff, and you can only wax poetic if you start trying to produce propositions and theorems, you're not going to do it. You're not even going to begin to do it. And yet it's laid open. The Tao itself is laid open. There is actually an obviousness about all this. As you said when you read it back there, you said, well, it seems self-evident to me, or words to that effect, didn't you?
Yeah.
You know, and the reader, there's that feeling. Of course, this is the beauty of the language. Even though we're dealing with translations, you do get that sense of what can be done with poetic language in these borders of the ineffable. Okay, he goes on. It's the endless source, endless river, river of no shape, river of no water, drifting invisibly from place to place. And he sees it as this kind of languid current, you know. But of course, what he's catching there is movement, but movement that's not kind of predictable by human standards or human calculation. It's meandering. From the human perspective, the Tao seems to meander. And its purpose, if there is any, seems difficult to discern. It never ends and it never fails. Well, it never ends. He's pointing up the infinity of it. You know, it never started, it never ends. This is a way of underscoring its infinity and therefore its fundamental nature, its primordiality. And it never fails. I mean, in some translations it says, you know, it leaves nothing undone. It's responsible for everything. You know, the phenomenal world, this human world that we inhabit, is its progeny. But not only are all these things, these trees and this water and this path, its progeny, they also are it. It's inside them, it envelops them, it produces them, it creates them and destroys them, but it is them at the same time. It's everything and nothing, you know. So that's chapter 6. And you see, you know, we do get a certain repetition. Chapter 7. Heaven and earth are enduring. The universe can live forever because it does not live for itself. And so both last, outliving themselves. The sage guides his people by putting himself last. Desiring nothing for himself, he knows how to channel desires. And is it not because he wants nothing that he is able to achieve everything? Well, again, you know, the point that's just been made is pretty well instantly repeated. You know, it lasts forever. I mean, it is a notion of the universe as a kind of steady state, I suppose. You know, or in infinite and eternal. You know, it lasts forever. And Lao Tzu is claiming that the Tao is able to do this because it doesn't want anything for itself. One presumes that if it wanted anything for itself, if it had purposes separate from what was actually being created and destroyed, separate from the processes of existence, that would somehow wear it out. I mean, I think, you know, it's a poetic language, but I think that's what he's trying to point up there. And then there's this switch. Suddenly he's talking about the Tao and its infinite and timeless nature. And he's talking about the sage. But the Tao has no purposes of its own. It's it's selfless in its creativity. But the sage in this story is meant to be in accord with the Tao, to have contact with the Tao, to have realised that the Tao in his own his or her own being. And therefore it will have all the qualities of the Tao. And the Tao lasts forever, isn't worn out, because it's unselfish. Similarly, the sage, I mean, of course, the sage is often characterised as immortal, you know. And remember, the Taoism that came later, the kind of alchemical Taoism, had this huge quest for immortality, you know, to live forever, like the Tao, by aligning oneself with the Tao. And this is where that came from. So this idea of the sage is somebody who succeeded in aligning themselves with the Tao, and will be similarly unselfish. As it says, the sage guides his people by putting himself last. And remember, the sage is intended to rule. You know, this is a reply to Confucian governmental theory. You know, which again has like the emperor or some kind of sagacious emperor. I mean, all of these governmental systems are conceived of as there is somebody who rules, a ruler. And for Lao Tzu, the sage is going to be the best ruler. And the Tao Te Ching is about politics, as much as it's about meditation and mysticism and so forth.
He's trying to encompass everything, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's a complete world picture.
Yeah.
In a handful of chapters, short chapters like this, you know. So desiring nothing for himself, he knows how to channel desires. I mean, he's actually talking there about you know, the desires of the people. Because he himself, he's not caught up in the compulsions of desire, according to this story. That gives him the insight and the clarity and all the rest of it to channel the desires of the people, which of course every ruler tries to channel the desires of the people. I mean, we're in the midst of an election campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
That's quite topical.
Yeah, and it's all about it's channeling the desires of the people, you know. Do they desire less tax over and against more public services, you know? And there's a to-ing and a fro-ing and a shouting and a waving and a flag waving in order to channel the desire of the people. But the Tao sage on this lovely story is, according to Lao Tzu, the most equipped to do that. And it says, I mean, the last line, and is it not because he wants nothing that he is able to achieve everything? I mean, this is a huge question, you know, the nature of desire.
Ooh,
you know, and I'm
kind of,
I'm struck so many times by the parallels between this and Plato's Republic, you know, and that Socrates is like a Taoist. He wants the city of pigs. Lao Tzu wants simple life in villages without weapons. And without getting urbane and sophisticated, you know, which he sees as kind of like a kind of a loss of contact with the Tao and with the nourishing nature of life when it's very very simple.
But it's not against utilising the technology of the time,
like
medicine and things.
That's right. I mean, by the same token, Taoism said it's very scientific, you know, compared with other ancient doctrines. And science went forward leaps and bounds in China as a result of this metaphysics, you know. So I mean, this is why I kind of stopped at desire there, you know, and saying he wants nothing, he's able to achieve everything, you know, and he knows. But he desires nothing for himself. But presumably he desires something for the whole. Otherwise, why would he be a ruler? You know? So it's not like desire's got this kind of connotation of evil and fallenness, as it does in many of the world's religious traditions. You know, we're told that we've been expelled from paradise, you know, because of desire. You know, Eve desired the knowledge, you know. And of course, sexually repressed Judeo-Christianity put that down to sex, you know. And presumably, you know, the sage got to this point of having no desires. By, at some point, at the beginning of his journey into sagacity, desiring no desire. So, this isn't some kind of ascetic demand to squash desire or to kill it or to cut it off at the root. It's rather, again, it's like a settling in, you know. And that is very much the thing of this down mysticism, downward pointing mysticism. That it's settling down, it's sinking in into things. And then, of course, if you...
But not passive.
Oh, no, not passive. Nice. That passive in that phase. Passive in that phase in order to be active in another phase.
Yeah.
Which is what this means, you know. Is it because he wants nothing, because he's settled and has got the perspective from that settled and sunken down into it experience, that he's able then to achieve everything? This is Wu Wei, you know, right at the core of Wu Wei. But we settle into the flow of things, into the broad river of the Tao. And in that way we know it. And it's that which enables us to do everything, you know. But it's not anti-desire, I don't think. And further on in the book, we do get to understand that he's not like anti-desire. I think where he stands on desire is that desire sort of attenuates when you let yourself settle down and becomes kind of. I mean, I almost said refined, you know. It becomes refined and unselfish. It broadens its scope. It takes into its embrace the people, the world, the fate of society. You know, because it's not in the straitjacket of a personal anxious frenzy for some kind of satisfaction. Possibly a satisfaction sought to ameliorate pain. It's not that. You know, it's not that kind of frenzy of desire. It's in the settling that desire opens its arms and embraces more and more. And that the reach of the sage's sympathies becomes very, very large. And again, this is a political issue. You know? I mean, there's such a lot of like left-right polarity and stuff these days in modern politics. But what it comes down to, and what I fail to see considered in any kind of clear way in the discourses that I'm seeing all over the place, you know, is that there's a tremendous issue about how far do we extend our sympathies? How wide do we make our embrace? You know, and this comes down to things. How many immigrants are we going to let in the country? How many refugees are we going to help? How much foreign aid are we going to give? Becomes the issues. Because there's a whole lot of people think, well, it's not humanly possible to extend your sympathies beyond perhaps your immediate family. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the only person I've ever heard say it like that many, many years ago was Enoch Powell. And he said, I mean, and of course he was like a right-wing mofo and the MP of one of the constituencies in this town at some point. And I mean, he actually said something. He said, you know, I love the man who loves his own. You know, he thought that your sympathies are not going to get much further than the country. Your first sympathy is towards your immediate family. Your second sympathy is towards the people in your class and caste in your immediate vicinity. And then you might be able to work up to like nationalism, you know, or patriotism. But after that, fuck it, you know. Now foreign aid. now sheltering the refugees. I mean, at least for all these kind of bloody flaws, the bloke brought that out. But I haven't heard it since. But this is exactly the issue. What is the proper extent of our sympathies? You know. And obviously, you know, things like Christianity and obviously let's say Judaism says, make your sympathies as big as you can, embrace the world. Whereas, you know, the kind of selfish, notion that what matters is the lone stranger, you know, the lone individual economic actor who pursues his rational self-interest, and that the way to make the world better is just to allow that. And sympathies don't go much beyond the one, you know, against the one person. Again, much further than the individual. And that is such a primordial distinction that's operating in politics in an unspoken way. But Lao Tzu got it, you know. I mean, obviously, he is on the side of, through meditation, being able to extend your sympathies, you know, as far, to the entire world. You know, I suppose most of us are not going to kind of get to that, you know. But at least Lao Tzu places it in front of us as something to head towards. Okay, I'm going to read the last one now, and I think this is the one that I wanted to spend a bit more time on, because there's some new material here. The sage's way, Tao, is the way of water. There must be water for life to be, and it can flow wherever. And water being true to being water is true to Tao. Those on the way of Tao, like water, need to accept where they find themselves. And they may often be where water goes, to the lowest places. And that is right. Like a lake, the heart must be calm and quiet, having great depth beneath it. The sage rules with compassion, and his words need to be trusted. The sage needs to know, like water, how to flow around the blocks, and how to find the way through without violence. Like water, the sage should wait for the moment to ripen and be right. Water, you know, never fights. It flows round without harm. And this is a newish theme. I mean, in the ancient world, East and West, there was always this effort to name an element that was most like everything, that was most fundamental. You know, in Heraclitus, it was fire. In Thales, it was, I think, was it air or water? You know. And then somebody else, in Pericles or somebody, said, oh, well, maybe there's four elements, earth, water, fire and air. You know, and you got the same thing in India, except they had five, you know, earth, water, fire, air and ether. And for them, ether was primordial, you know. But for Lao Tzu, it's water. Water is the primordial element. Because it's like the Tao, because it flows. And because it sinks down to low places, it always finds the lowest place, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
We're actually sitting by a very beautiful patch of water right now.
I know, yeah, and there's some kind of rushes, and I just saw a fish do a little hop there, out the surface. And there's a moor end up there looking for its dinner. But yeah.
But again, this is like very topical because of the election and everything coming up.
Mm.
And the sage rules with compassion, and his words need to be trusted. Wouldn't that be bloody wonderful, hey? Couldn't we have a ruler like that?
Well, nobody trusts anybody in the modern world, you know. Again, this is a part of the values intrinsic in pretty well in all modern societies, which promote the individual to the highest value. You know, the homo economicus, you know, the rational actor pursuing his own self-interest. And compassion don't figure in that, because you pursue your own self-interest. And in the fond and magical belief that somehow this is for the good of the whole. If we all pursue our rational self-interest, the invisible hand will harmonise it all. But actually, there's no room for compassion. There's no room for compassion. No, I mean, Lao Tzu is probably a laissez-faire waller. You know, he's very much for not over-interfering. But he does see that the unit of human concern is the community, and in fact, like the world in the end, you know. Hence the need for compassion. A ruler must be compassionate. And I would say that this notion of the sage as somebody who's in intimate contact with the Tao is automatically compassionate, because, you know, the Tao is the mother of all things. You know, and what do mothers do? They care. They tend to. They nurse. They nurture. You know, and the Tao is like that. And the Tao is therefore compassionate, you know, and the sage is therefore compassionate. And even though we're having a go at effing the ineffable here, one thing we can usefully say about this great fusion of opposites is it's a love or compassion or something that's in that ballpark is very, very much a feature. And if you contact the Tao, you will feel that as a palpable and powerful emotion. And it would be very difficult for anybody who's experienced that to go back to becoming the lone individual of modern capitalism. It's not on. But water, yeah, this thing of water, you know, water is very accommodating. Yeah. If it wants to go somewhere and there's an obstacle, it flows around it. And I do favour this, you know, the as a strategic way of operating in life, be like water, yeah. Flow around, you know, and avoid the violence of the head-on conflict, and you get things done, you know. And it tells you, it says, like a lake, the heart must be calm and quiet, having great depth beneath it. And that is the Taoist meditation, is one of sitting and settling, or walking and settling, you know, or lying down and settling. But, you know, if you're going to do sitting meditation, it's settling. And Lao Tzu says elsewhere, you know, for meditation, go deep in the heart. This is what he means, you know, and that the heart is the organ of thinking, feeling, or feeling, thinking. And if you allow it to settle, it becomes kind of placid. It becomes like water that's sunk down, you know, to the lowest place that it can find. But you find that there's great depths beneath it, you know. This is like a big, deep, still lake, you know, that you can see down through the water. And there's infinite depth in there. Again, this is down mysticism, you know, into depths of water. And this is a profound teaching in three lines, you know. Like a lake, the heart must be calm and quiet, having great depth beneath it. This is what the sage does. And then the sage, is, as a result, is able to rule with compassion. And actually say trustworthy things, you know. Now, whether the people trust or not, another matter, you know. But I say, certainly we have a culture of distrust. You're crazy if you trust, you know, if you trust other people in our world. And if
we have been kind of outrageously lied to by politicians over the last
2,000-3,000 years, yeah. So there's a bit of the utopian in the guy as well, isn't there, you know? So I think I'll just mention one last thing out of this bit. To do with what happens if you align yourself with the doe, and he says you may often find yourself where water goes, to the lowest places, and that is right. You know, the attempt at sagacity, you know, the undertaking of the doe's meditational trip will lead you to low places. You know, and I think, and as he says, that is right, and I think he's saying something very, very interesting there, you know, that that you don't necessarily have to kind of seek mountain tops, you know, that you don't have to necessarily seek the company of kings. That rather you can go to the tavern. You know, and you can, and that you may find clues and hints and tips in the market, yeah, and down amongst the beggars. And again, that is something that you find. You will find that. I can't tell you how or why or say any more about it, but you will find that if you have a little play with this trip. All right, I said that was the last thing, but one other thing here, you know, like water, the sage should wait for the moment to ripen and be right. Water, you know, never fights. Timing, you know, knowing how to wait. This lack of urgency that you get in Taoism, because the Tao has no urgency. You know, it's neither tardy nor urgent. It just meanders river-like through things. You know, timing, and of course this is the stuff that's taken up in the Taoist martial arts. You know, in Tai Chi, you don't see how much aggression you can muster, how fast and wiry and invulnerable and strong you can be, like a mixed martial arts fighter or something like that. You know. These guys are able to harness enormous amounts of pure aggression. The Taoist way, the Tai Chi way, is to get out of the way. It's to sidestep and let the bloke trip over himself.
Yeah.
You know, and you get then Aikido and Judo and so forth. Is you know, the desire to lessen aggression, to improve timing, and to be like water. So there's all kinds of stuff in here. There's strategy for living, strategy for ruling, meditation, instruction, a value system, a political value system that values compassion and the extension of sympathies over and against the contraction of sympathies of conservatism. And a whole host of things, again, in this is perhaps one of the longer chapters, but it's still only a couple of hundred words or something, you know. And quite magnificent.
Yes, definitely. It's a bit windy today, so I hope that didn't disturb the recording too much. And I hope you found it useful. And if you did and you'd like to support us, if you'd like to become a patron, that would be lovely. Help us pay the rent and keep food in our bellies. There's at the top of the podcast page, there's a little green button that says become a patron.
Yes.
So if you click on that, it'll take you to the patrons page.
Yeah, as Lao Tzu says, come down here with the beggars and you'll learn some shit.
All right, I'll speak to you soon.
Bye-bye.